Hello, listeners, and welcome to Iris and to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. It's Friday, July 22nd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at the weather forecast. We are watching some scattered showers and storms rolling into our area this morning. No severe weather is expected, and most of this should be out of here by lunchtime. Plan on highs well into the 80s. Late tonight, this same front may generate some more scattered storms, some with heavy rain and small hail. Tomorrow, plan on high heat and humidity, with a chance of storms in the afternoon and evening. Some of these may be strong and severe, with wind and hail the primary threats. A heat advisory has been issued for areas along and south of I-80 for tomorrow afternoon as well. By Sunday, all of this moves southeast, leaving us in the lower 80s for highs on Sunday. Now, here are the stories on the front page of the Courier today. Legislature urged by Attorney General to stem the tide of overdoses. Locals get excited about historic $660 million jackpot. Cedar Falls hands out Melendi Spirit Awards. And we'll begin reading the top story on the page, Iowa Plans for Future Drought. Aaron Jordan of the Gazette wrote this story, and the dateline is Cedar Rapids. As nights stay hotter and precipitation is less consistent, Iowa is at risk for more frequent droughts. That's why state officials want to develop a plan that would include a trigger point to call for precautions such as water rationing. Quote, "The benefit of a trigger is it gives you something to point to," said Tom Hall, chief of the Iowa Geological and Water Survey Bureau at the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. About 20 emergency management officials, water treatment employees, and others gathered Thursday at Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids to talk about the need for a drought plan and what should go into it. This is one of five stakeholder meetings across the state. The nonprofit Climate Central group of scientists and communicators reported Iowa, Montana, and Oklahoma have the worst drought vulnerability among all 50 states based on exposure and sensitivity to drought, as well as their ability to adapt to it, state climatologist Justin Glisson said on Thursday. Quote, "We don't irrigate across the state or have the ability to irrigate," Glisson said of Iowa's agricultural crops, primarily corn and soybeans. Quote, "Our crops need water. Corn needs 25 inches of water per year to grow," unquote. Glisson and other state officials hope that by creating a drought plan, Iowa can reduce its vulnerability. The long-term climate trends are concerning, Glisson said. Iowa's average daily temperature has increased about 1.3 degrees since 1895. That doesn't sound like a lot, but the bulk of that change is happening at night, when cloud cover traps the heat from the day close to the earth. Quote, "Not cooling off at night exacerbates drought conditions," Glisson said. A warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor, about 4% more in Iowa, and doesn't let it go as rain until it reaches critical mass. That means some of Iowa is more likely to get 3 to 4 inches of rain in a few hours, leaving parts of the state very wet, while others still are experiencing drought, Glisson said. Much of Iowa faced drought this last summer. Despite a wet October, when an average 5 inches of rain fell across the state, much of Iowa is still dry. The U.S. Drought Monitor's most recent Iowa map, published online Thursday, shows extreme drought extending into a third of northwest Iowa County, as compared with the previous week, in southeast Iowa developing a pocket of moderate drought. Participants at Thursday's meeting said the drought plan should factor in rainfall, both here and in the watershed farther north, temperature and soil moisture. They said having a state plan that defines drought will make it easier to impose water restrictions if necessary. Hall said one idea is to create a drought website similar to the Iowa Flood Information System that could gather data on drought risks and model how that would affect different parts of the state. The Iowa DNR, Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship plan to create by October a draft plan that will be available for public comment. They hope to have a final plan by the end of the year. Our next headline is, locals get excited about Mega Millions' historic $660 million jackpot. Story written by Andy Malone. And it begins with a photograph of two people at a convenience store, a clerk and a customer. And the caption says, Tony Dunn of Parkersburg buys a Mega Millions ticket from cashier Alex Hogg on Thursday. Dateline is Cedar Falls. When the Mega Millions grand prize hit $660 million, the nation's ninth largest jackpot ever, people who don't normally play come out of the woodwork to buy a $2 ticket. There have been 27 consecutive drawings in which no one matched all six numbers, and that's allowed the jackpot to grow from its $20 million starting point in April. On Thursday afternoon at Casey's on Nordic Drive, cashier Jamie Worrell said every three or four-ish people who walked inside was hoping to get lucky in tonight's drawing. Jim Clemens of Waterloo was one of them. He had a dozen co-workers at Echo Electric Supply each put $5 into a pool to buy tickets whenever the price climbs above $500 million. If he wins, he says, he won't be going to work tomorrow. Quote, I don't think anyone would, he said. Chris Bolhus of Wellsburg, who won $1,000 on a scratch ticket a few months ago, agrees that the jackpot has to grow well beyond the baseline prize before he decides to play Mega Millions. Quote, $20 million would do me nothing, he said. That's a bad trip to Vegas, and maybe two trips to Cabela's before the money is gone. But in all seriousness, if he'd won, he'd pay off student loan debt and buy some McDonald's, specifically a Big Mac and fries. Like Clements, Eric Estes from Hudson waits until the jackpot is over $500 million to buy a ticket, when he feels the odds to win are crazy high. Quote, maybe the stars will line up right, Estes said. Quote, my father-in-law always says the lottery is like an idiot tax, he added. But eventually, the funds go to good things. He would give half the winnings to the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital because the people there saved his child's life. Additionally, he'd give some of his parents and younger brother so that they'd be debt-free. And the rest of it, he would spend on rest and play. Kathy Smits of Cedar Falls has bought a ticket the last three times the prize has grown. Her father enjoyed playing, and in honor of him, she'd been using his go-to numbers. I'll share the winnings with friends and do what I can to make the world a better place, she said. Mega Millions drawings are held at 11 p.m. every Tuesday and Friday. Even as the big prize has increased, the odds of winning all that money have remained the same, 1 in 302.5 million. The highlighted pre-tax $660 million prize is for a winner who takes an annuity option, paid out in 30 annual installments. Most players choose the cash option, which, for Friday's drawing, would be $376.9 million. On Tuesday, the numbers were 2, 31, 32, 37, 70, plus the gold Mega Ball, 25, according to the lottery's website. Mega Millions is played in 45 states as well as Washington, D.C., and the U.S. Virgin Islands. The game is overseen by state lottery officials. The Courier's Melody Parker wrote this next story. Blues guitarist, community volunteer, are posthumous winners of Melody Spirit Awards. The dateline is Cedar Falls. Longtime volunteer Mary Taylor and country blues guitarist Eddie Bowles have been named 2022 Melody Spirit Award winners. It is the first time two recipients have been recognized posthumously for the award in the same year, said Sally Kliss Timmer, Executive Director of the Cedar Falls Community Foundation. The award recognizes individuals, families, groups, or organizations, both living and deceased, who have made outstanding contributions to Cedar Falls, the impact, the quality of life. It is named for Peter Melendi, who at 36 became a Cedar Falls resident in 1859 and contributed to the city's cultural life and economic development. Quote, usually we recognized one posthumous award per year. We thought both of these individuals were very worthy of receiving the Melendi Spirit Award. Mary passed away recently and left our community too soon, but she was very impactful and involved. We also had a resurgence of interest in Eddie Bowles and realized his impact on the community through his music and his kindness, Timmer said. Interest in Eddie Bowles was revived earlier this year when an exhibition of his life and music was featured at the Hearst Center for the Arts. The display was produced by 14 University of Northern Iowa students as a class project and included several musical performances by Cedar Valley musicians influenced by Bowles. Bowles died in 1984 at the age of 100, one of Cedar Falls' first black residents. His name and music is well remembered by many area musicians and residents. Born in 1884 in Lafayette, Louisiana, he learned to play blues and jazz on homemade instruments before his parents bought him instruments to play. He played in several orchestras, including with Louis Armstrong. He married Sarah Blanche in 1911 and came north to find work. In 1914, he worked as a street paver, laying Cedar Falls' first brick streets. He also was employed by local railroads, worked at John Deere Foundry for 22 years, and as a tree trimmer. Cedar Falls poet James Hearst wrote a poem about Bowles, published in Hearst's 1981 book, quote, Time Like a Furrow, unquote. In the 1960s, Bowles returned to his musical roots, playing for family and friends. He also was sought out by young musicians wanting to learn his unique picking style of guitar playing. He continued playing into his 90s. Beyond music, Bowles had a generous, kind spirit, and the Bowles home was always a safe place for children who needed an escape from time to time. He also made sure each child had a new pair of shoes for the school year. Bowles is the first African American to receive the Melendi Spirit Award. Quote, it's important that we recognize the diversity that we have in the Cedar Valley and the efforts of people of all races and backgrounds to make our community a better place to live, Timmer explained. Mary Taylor, who died October 13, 2020, was a Waterloo native whose family valued volunteer work, a trait she carried throughout her life. Her impact has been profound and notable, said Timmer. Although she didn't draw a lot of attention to her volunteer and leadership efforts. Quote, some people are unsung heroes, and the public doesn't know all the different projects and organizations they're involved in. It's important to recognize their efforts and shows other people what a difference they can make in their communities, Timmer explained. Taylor graduated from the University of Northern Iowa and began her career in community involvement at the Cedar Falls Tourism Bureau, before becoming a director of marketing at the University of Northern Iowa. She later joined Western Home Communities as director of development. She was actively involved in cultivating an award-winning Cedar Falls Main Street and provided leadership on such historic preservation projects as the Old Post Office. She helped create the Cedar Falls Authors Festival and volunteered for Cedar Trails Partnership, Friends of Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center, and more than 25 other community organizations. In addition, she raised funds for Western Home Staff scholarships. The Mary Taylor Health Sciences Scholarship was established in her name with the Western Home Foundation. Taylor was posthumously inducted into the Iowa Volunteer Hall of Fame and received the Representative Citizen Award from the City of Cedar Falls and Cedar Falls Utilities. Our next story comes from Caleb McCullough of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau, and it is titled, Iowa Attorney General Calls for Harm Reduction Strategies to Curb Fentanyl Overdoses. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller called on the legislature to pass laws making it easier for people to test drugs for fentanyl and obtain overdose-reversing medications on Thursday. In a press conference, Miller said state lawmakers should legalize fentanyl testing strips, which can be used to test whether fentanyl is present in a pill or other substance, and expand the availability of naloxone, a medication that can reverse the effects of an opioid overdose and prevent death. Naloxone, under the brand name Narcan, is available for free without a prescription at some pharmacies in Iowa, but Miller said the state should authorize nonprofits and government agencies to distribute the medication as well. Miller's comments came on the heels of Republican Governor Kim Reynolds announcing plans last week to ratchet up awareness messaging at the state level about the dangers of fentanyl and illicit drug use. Fentanyl is involved in the vast majority of opioid deaths in Iowa, being present in 83% of opioid deaths last year. Overall drug overdose deaths have increased 34% in the last 2 years, from 350 in 2019 to 470 in 2021. Fentanyl, a synthetic opioid that is up to 100 times stronger than morphine, is often added to illicit pills and other drugs, primarily because it makes the drugs cheaper to produce. Last week, Reynolds highlighted its presence in counterfeit pills that look like prescription drugs, such as Oxycontin and Percocet. Currently, fentanyl's test strips are considered drug paraphernalia in Iowa. Possessing paraphernalia is a simple misdemeanor, punishable by up to 30 days in jail or a fine of $855. Quote, this should not be a partisan issue, Miller said. Quote, this is a harm reduction issue. This is a public health issue, unquote. Miller, a Democrat, said he'd had discussions with legislators on measures during the last legislative session, and he's hoping he can get support from both parties on passing the two laws. Several states, including Georgia and Wisconsin, have decriminalized fentanyl test strips in recent years, with buy-in from Democrats and Republicans in their state legislatures. The National Association of Attorneys General, which Miller leads as president, has bipartisan support for the measure, Miller said. Quote, dealing with this terrible set of issues concerning prescription opioids and fentanyl, it hasn't been a part of this partisan issue in Iowa, he said. Story County Sheriff Paul Fitzgerald said at the press conference that fentanyl test strips can be used by drug users to prevent overdoses. Quote, this will allow the user to be able to either test the batch they have, and if fentanyl is present during that, they can at that time choose a different batch. They can use less of what they have. They can have the option to have others there when they use it, or have Narcan available, he said. Under current law, distributing naloxone outside a pharmacy is prohibited, but Miller urged the legislature to pass a bill to allow community organizations and nonprofits to apply to the state and receive naloxone that can be distributed to the public. Under the proposed rules, the groups would not collect identifying information for the state's prescription monitoring program. Miller said the best option for people addicted to opioids is to seek treatment, but that these measures would lower the chances of fatal overdose for those not in treatment. Quote, there's no better time to get into treatment, he said. Quote, and treatment is really the answer for people that are addicted, unquote. Now let's turn the page to the Cedar Valley section, and the top story is Waterloo Tracks Trash Carts, filed by Maria Cooper. The story begins with a photograph taken inside the cab of a trash truck, and the caption says, the cab of Dennis Moore's garbage truck is now equipped with a screen that provides radio frequency identification information attached to the trash bins is part of an effort by Waterloo Public Works, and you can see a fairly large screen above the driver's position where it shows a list of trash cans that are available for pickup. Dateline Waterloo. Waterloo's solid waste system is almost finished adding a game-changing technology update and is asking residents to follow new rules. Waterloo Public Works is almost done installing radio frequency identification tags on all its trash carts. The tags help solid waste technicians identify which cans they've picked up along their route. However, some residents are tampering with the tags, which causes problems with pickups. The tags are blue and about 4 inches long. If a trash can was made after 2017, the bin will have the tracker inside. If it was made before 2017, the tag is on the outside. Randy Bennett, the city's public works director, says a small percentage of residents move their carts, damage the tags, or cover them, use the wrong cart, or use the wrong size cart. After August 17th, first-time offenders will receive a fine of $250. Any subsequent offenses will incur a $500 fine. Bennett said if someone returns an unregistered cart before August 17th, there will be no fine. The carts can be returned to the Waterloo Public Works, 625 Glenwood Street. There is also a $20 go-back fee charged to residents who request drivers to return to dump a cart that was not out on time, overloaded, or blocked. Quote, "This doesn't affect most residents," Bennett said. "It's for the people who know what they are doing is wrong. The reasons people tamper with the tags is to hide the fact that they are using the wrong type of can," Bennett said. "This includes using a larger can than the customer is paying for, or using more than one cart without paying for it. The tags aren't just for keeping residents, landlords, or management companies accountable," Sanitation Director Scott Brunson said. "The program also keeps workers in line. When the drivers pick up a can, they check it off on a screen inside the truck. That information goes back to the public works office, where people like Bennett and Brunson can keep track of the driver's route. The program the office uses shows where all the drivers are on a map. They can then click on an individual driver and see what address they're at, as well as times and dates of previous pickups. It also shows how many stops the driver has left and their efficiency rate. Along with the RFID program, the Public Works Department installed 4 cameras on each truck. The driver can take a snapshot that shows an issue, such as a bin not being curbside or one that is overflowing. The photo is sent back to Public Works. If someone calls about an issue, the Public Works office can verify why their trash was not picked up, with photographic evidence. Despite the addition of the technology on the trucks, Bennett said, those improvements have not increased property owners' taxes. The implementation brought in $10,000 in revenue by requiring people to pay for the correct cart. Bennett said the added revenue will delay fee increases. Currently, a 32-gallon can costs $10 per month. A 65-gallon container is $11.75 per month, and a 96-gallon bin is $17.75 per month. Residents who are unsure of the size of their cart are asked to contact the Public Works Office at area code 319-291-4455 to confirm it is correctly registered. Our next story was written by Andy Malone. Stolen vehicle chase leads law enforcement through Blackhawk and Buchanan counties. Dateline Cedar Valley. An Illinois driver in a stolen vehicle led police on a chase early Thursday morning through Waterloo, Cedar Falls, and eventually into Jessup. John Thomas Vesey, 28, of Elizabeth, Illinois, allegedly reached speeds of 125 miles per hour, went through multiple red lights, and was arrested after hitting spike strips. He was charged with multiple traffic violations, reckless driving, and eluding. The pursuit started at about midnight Thursday near the corner of Franklin and East 2nd Streets when Waterloo police attempted a traffic stop on the stolen 2017 white Ford Fusion. Vasey initially stopped, but then fled and led police close to city limits, at which point the Black Hawk County Sheriff's Office took the lead in the chase. The car traveled in excess of 110 miles per hour on Broadway Street in a posted 55-mile-per-hour zone and ran the red light at the off-ramp for U.S. Highway 218 prior to Airport Boulevard. The vehicle traveled in excess of 110 miles per hour on U.S. Highway 218 into Cedar Falls, a posted 65-mile-per-hour zone. The vehicle traveled at speeds in excess of 110 miles per hour on First Street in Cedar Falls and posted 45 and 35-mile-per-hour zones, running a red light at First and Main Streets. The vehicle continued at more than 110 in a 30-mile-per-hour zone on First Street before turning onto Hudson Road, where the vehicle entered the wrong lane of traffic and traveled in excess of 70 in a posted 35-mile-per-hour zone and construction area. The vehicle continued at speeds in excess of 110 through Cedar Falls and onto U.S. Highway 20, where it headed eastbound until reaching the Jessup exit in Buchanan County. At that point, it was traveling at speeds in excess of 125 miles per hour in a posted 65-mile-per-hour zone. After entering Buchanan County, Vasey continued to elude before he hit spike strips. The sheriff's vehicle also hit the strips. Vasey's vehicle later became disabled. Vasey was taken into custody about 3 miles from where the sheriff's vehicle was disabled. Our next story was filed by the Courier staff, and it's titled, Deer Announces Production Shifts at Ottumwa Plant, Dateline Ottumwa. John Deere will move some production from Ottumwa to Mexico by the end of 2023, but simultaneously announced plans to revitalize its Ottumwa plant for the future. The company Thursday announced that over the next 18 months, John Deere mower conditioner production will transition from Ottumwa Works to the company's existing hay and forage mower factory in Monterrey, Mexico, 1,100 miles away. The number of employees impacted is not yet known, the company said. The ultimate number will depend on potential reassignment opportunities once the move is made and overall production levels at the John Deere Ottumwa Works plant. Dan Burnick, the company's public relations manager, told the Ottumwa Courier, the move consolidates the company's mowing implements to a single location with, quote, existing production capacity and complementary manufacturing competencies, unquote. The Ottumwa plant also makes round balers, self-propelled wind rowers, and square balers. Burnick said the company will also invest in the Ottumwa plant. The company also announced Thursday plans to revitalize the facility for the future. The company says this will include a focus on the other products it makes at the Ottumwa plant, specifically leveraging new processes and technologies to further improve quality and productivity. On June 1st, the company announced its Waterloo cab and welding operation will move to Ramos Arizpe, Mexico, by the year 2024. Union leaders said at the time they were told no Waterloo jobs would be affected because new product is coming in. According to the company, the number of employees affected will depend on production volumes, employee attrition over the next 2 years, and new product program needs. Listeners, at this time, we want to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, July 22nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. There are no obituaries listed in today's paper, so let's continue reading local news from the Courier. Continuing on the Cedar Valley section, we have a story filed by Donald Promnitz. Local educators apply STEM knowledge in externship program. The dateline is Cedar Falls. University of Northern Iowa education student Hannah Bustamante is experimenting with ways to get children excited about science. and she's recruited her friend Taco as her lab assistant. Taco, a turtle that's found a home at Hartman Nature Reserve, was presented to a group of children from Denver and Waverly on Thursday. She quickly caught their interest and was able to help Bustamante start their lesson on nature, wildlife, and conservation. Quote, "We have a lot of kids come through here during the summer for camps, and we're here to help them learn about nature, learn about different science things, to teach them about things that maybe they don't see in their normal lives," Bustamante said. Bustamante is one of 80 externs attached to a program set up by Governor Kim Reynolds' STEM, Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics Advisory Council, that pairs 80 teachers with local STEM workplaces. Quote, "What I want to do here is be able to learn how to incorporate different outside world things into my future classroom to have more effective teaching," Bustamante said. "Science often is a subject that's best learned hands-on, a lesson she has learned quickly. It's one thing to talk about nature and animals, and another to show them the animals and, when possible, interact." She's already found ways to apply this technique outside of her externship. Bustamante is studying to teach chemistry. She applied her knowledge at a Harry Potter-themed camp in which she taught poison-making in the form of at-home experiments. She's also done lessons on the chemistry of starting fires. She says that always gets a more positive response when children see things pop and fizz, and she looks forward to incorporating applied science in the classroom when she has one of her own. Quote, "I think there's a lot of things that I've realized that kids are really interested in and not so interested in that have kind of shown me what I can and can't bring into the classroom to help them be a little bit more interested," unquote. Quote, "What I want to do here is be able to learn how to incorporate different outside world things into my future classroom to have more effective teaching," unquote. Okay, listeners, despite what I said earlier, there is one death notice published in the Courier today. R. Maxine Freeland, 98, of Victorville, California, formerly of Waterloo, died Tuesday, July 12, 2022, at the Knowles West Point Acute Hospital in Victorville, California. Arrangements are being made with Locke Funeral Services. Now back to local news with a story written by Andy Malone. Several more arrests expected in connection to Mexican drug operations presence in Black Hawk County, Dateline Waterloo. Local law enforcement agents expect several more arrests in connection to a two-year-long investigation into a Mexico-based drug trafficking organization's presence in Black Hawk County. Waterloo police announced Thursday a third person was arrested last week on felony money laundering charges by the Tri-County Drug Enforcement Task Force and several other agencies. Megan Jolene Haying, 22, of New Hampton, allegedly distributed methamphetamine from the organization and also participated in the movement of the drug proceeds twice last year and once this year from Black Hawk County to Culiacan, Sinaloa, Mexico. She was involved three times in the wire transfer of funds, which totaled about $2,500, and faces three money laundering charges. Richard Lewis Mohorn, 46, and Mark Anthony Silas, 31, also were charged last week in connection with each transferring some $900 in proceeds last year from Black Hawk County to the Monjores drug trafficking organization in Mexico. Mohorn allegedly transferred the funds on two occasions. According to the criminal affidavit, detectives identified one of the main operators in Mexico who was supplying Black Hawk County individuals with large amounts of methamphetamine, heroin, and fentanyl. The operator was supplying another defendant with pounds of methamphetamine and thousands of pills containing fentanyl. That individual then provided Salas, Mahorn, and Haling with methamphetamine to sell. Next, argument leads Waterloo woman to bite a large piece of flesh off a man's forearm. Story filed by Andy Malone. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo woman was arrested Wednesday night after allegedly biting a large piece of flesh off a man's forearm during an argument. Kayla Sharon Torres, 39, of Waterloo, was charged with two felonies, a third offense domestic abuse assault, and willful injury. According to the criminal affidavit, police were responding to the residence in the 600 block of West 1st Street at 7:33 p.m. for an assault when officers found the victim out in front of the building with the severe injury to his right forearm. Blood was splattered all around the apartment and down the stairs on the outside of the building. An ambulance crew members said they could see his bone and tendon, the affidavit stated. Bond was set at $10,000. A preliminary hearing is scheduled for July 29th. This next is filed by the Courier staff. Cedar Falls police arrest a man for drag racing and eluding charges. Dateline Cedar Falls. Police have arrested a driver who was reportedly drag racing at about 9:30 p.m. Tuesday, southbound on Highway 58 toward Green Hill Road. Andrew Winters, 18, allegedly continued southbound in a white car in excess of 100 miles per hour. He eluded police, but was tracked down and charged Wednesday with eluding, drag racing, reckless driving, and speeding. Police said an officer observed the white car, as well as a dark-colored truck, beginning to drag race on Tuesday. Police said they identified both vehicles, but have not announced any charges for the second driver. Next, Gladbrook Rhinebeck receives petition for ballot measure. Story filed by Donald Promnitz. If passed, the $23.6 million bond would go toward upgrades on HVAC systems, a gym expansion, and the junior-senior high school classroom additions at the elementary school, and secured entries at both buildings. There are also plans to make all restrooms handicap accessible. Quote, after many months of planning and the engagement of our community, we are pleased that the board has decided to move forward with a sound solution to our district's facility needs, said Eric Smith, superintendent. Quote, the tremendous work of our task force and the input provided by residents through our survey have allowed us to move forward in a thoughtful and comprehensive way, unquote. An approved bond would have a property tax impact of $199.58 annually, $1,663 per month, on a home assessed at $100,000. For agricultural land, the impact would be anywhere from $5.36 to $6.62 per acre annually, depending on the location in Tama, Blackhawk, Grundy, or Marshall County. Next, diesel prices squeeze truckers and farmers and consumers. Story filed by Kathy Buzwitz of the Associated Press, and it begins with a photograph of a truck driver delivering gas to a station. Dateline New York. When long-haul trucker Deb LaBrie sets out on the road to deliver pharmaceuticals, she has strategies to hold down costs. She avoids the West Coast and the Northeast, where diesel prices are the highest. She organizes her delivery route to minimize deadheading, driving an empty truck in between deliveries. And if a customer's load is too far away or they can't pay for more fuel, she turns the job down. It breaks my heart because I either have to say, no, I can't afford to, or I can, but you're going to have to pay some of my fuel to get there, LaBrie said. I hate doing both of those things, but it's not the customer's fault. It's not our fault either, unquote. The price of diesel fuel has skyrocketed in recent months, much more even than regular gasoline, especially after Russia invaded Ukraine in February. Moscow's attack led numerous nations to spurn Russian fuel, removing from the market a major source of oil, the main component of diesel fuel, and driving prices drastically up. For months, Motorists have felt the pain of high gasoline prices. Many may not know that they're also absorbing the impact of much costlier diesel fuel. That's because the goods consumers buy, from cereal and orange juice to Amazon deliveries of diapers, are delivered by trucks, trains, or ships that run on diesel. Those inflated prices are then passed on from company to company until they reach consumers in the form of costlier goods. Quote, people pay less attention to diesel prices because people aren't going to the pump and using it, said Matt Smith, lead oil analyst at Kepler, a research firm. But diesel has a more far-reaching impact and is already having a real big impact across the country. Diesel fuel is averaging $5.50 a gallon nationally, up 68% from a year ago, when it was selling for just $3.27. By comparison, a gallon of regular gasoline is averaging $4.47, up 41% from last year. High gasoline prices eased somewhat in recent weeks, but diesel has remained chronically high, with American refineries operating near capacity. Unless prices ease, the ripple effects of high diesel fuel could worsen because the costs are deterring some truck companies from accepting jobs unless they can persuade their customers to pay more for fuel. Quote, there will be more logistical shortages, said Phil Verliger, a longtime energy economist. Quote, Americans will find more empty shelves and higher prices, unquote. If they're not rejecting jobs, many truckers are choosing lighter loads or working longer hours to make up for money lost on fuel, according to interviews with truckers and industry executives. Farmers harvesting hay and planting corn with diesel-fired tractors are absorbing a financial hit. Delivery companies are installing their own fuel pumps to cut costs. Ultimately, consumers are left bearing the burden. Quote, if you're a farmer, then your energy costs are higher, and therefore it's costing more to produce grain, and that's pushing the price of grain up, and that's pushing the price of food up, Smith said at Kepler. Even more than gasoline, high diesel prices are magnifying the cost of goods because the delivery cost has risen so much. Consumer prices soared 9.1% in June, compared with 12 months earlier. The government reported last week the fuel oil portion of the consumer price index nearly doubled from the same time last year. Quote, those energy costs are working their way into all manner of different consumer products, Smith noted. One reason why diesel prices haven't yet declined as gasoline has is that OPEC nations slowed their supply of oil, and Middle East oil typically produces more diesel fuel than, say, parts of Texas do. Another factor is that China reduced its diesel exports, presumably to help achieve its net zero greenhouse gas emissions goals. Within the United States, refineries that produce diesel from crude oil are essentially maxed out. The nation has 11 fewer refineries operating today than before the pandemic, according to the American Petroleum Institute. One refinery that had served the East Coast closed after an explosion in 2019 and never reopened. And some refineries in California are closed for retrofitting to process renewable fuel. Quote, we use a lot of diesel, probably more than what these refineries can produce, said Bob Costello, chief economist of the American Trucking Associations. President Joe Biden's visit last week to Saudi Arabia was intended, in part, to encourage OPEC to produce more oil, which would mean more diesel fuel globally. Though no major deal was announced, Prince Mohammed bin Salman hinted that Saudi Arabia could potentially produce more oil. But expecting OPEC to export more oil during high-demand summer months might be unrealistic, said Amy Myers Jaff, an energy expert at Tufts University. Quote, the important thing, she said, is to make sure that our allies, together with OPEC, don't decrease any flows to the market at any junction, especially if we have some kind of disruption, unquote. And now, turning the page, we find the Campaign Almanac. Internal polls show close campaigns in Iowa, and story submitted by the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Three Iowa congressional districts, three razor-close campaigns, either tied or separated by a single percentage point. That's according to new rounds of polling published this week. In eastern Iowa's new 2nd congressional district, Republican incumbent Ashley Hinson and Democratic challenger Liz Mathis are locked in a dead heat, according to polling commissioned by the Mathis campaign. Hinson and Mathis are tied at 44%, according to the poll from Public Policy Polling, a national pollster frequently employed by Democratic candidates. The poll also asked respondents the so-called generic ballot question, do you plan to vote for the Republican or Democrat candidate for Congress? To that question, 50% said Republican and 43% said the Democrat. But when the poll later asked whether voters planned to support Hinson or Mathis, the results were a draw. Public Policy Polling surveyed 594 second district voters from July 19th and the 20th. The poll's margin for error is plus or minus 4 percentage points. In eastern Iowa's new first district, an internal poll released by Christina Bohannon's campaign showed the Democratic challenger trailing Republican incumbent Marionette Miller Meeks by a single percentage point. The poll was part of a Change Research poll conducted for Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Mike Franken and released last week. Surveying likely voters between June 30th and July 4th, Miller Meeks polled ahead 39% to 38%, according to the Bohannon campaign. Nearly 22% of those surveyed said they were undecided. The statewide poll sampled 1,488 likely voters and had a margin of error of plus or minus 2.7 percentage points. In central Iowa's 3rd congressional district, Democratic U.S. Representative Sidney Acney and Republican challenger Zach Nunn also are locked in a dead heat, according to a new poll from a company that does polling for Republican candidates. Acney and Nunn both reached 43% in More Information Group's poll of 400 likely 3rd district voters. According to the results, 14% of voters said they remain undecided. The poll was conducted July 9th through the 11th and has a margin of error of plus or minus 5 percentage points. PAC endorses Mathis. The Equality PAC, the political arm of the Congressional LGBTQ Equality Caucus, endorsed Democratic State Senator Liz Mathis of Hiawatha in her race for Iowa's 2nd congressional district. Mathis is running against Marion Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, who is seeking re-election in the November general election. Quote, through her nonprofit work and service in Iowa's State Senate, Liz has a deep understanding of the struggles that Iowans face on a daily basis. Equality PAC co-chairs U.S. Representatives Mark Takano and David Cicilline said in a statement provided by Mathis's campaign. Quote, with Liz's voice in Congress, we can advance LGBTQ rights and pass the Equality Act to help the LGBTQ community in Iowa and across the nation, unquote. Equality PAC raises funds spent supporting and electing openly LGBTQ individuals and LGBTQ allies in Congress. Franken endorsement. Brady PAC, the political arm of a national gun violence prevention advocacy group, included Mike Franken, the Democratic candidate in Iowa's U.S. Senate campaign, among its latest round of endorsements across the country. Franken, a former Navy admiral from Sioux City, is challenging Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley. Quote, we need leaders at the state and federal levels who will fight for bold and decisive action on gun safety, Brady PAC Executive Director Jason Pressburg said in a news release. Quote, smart gun laws work and save lives. We are proud to support this cohort of leaders who are committed to enacting, improving, and defending gun violence prevention policies across the country, unquote. The PAC's latest round of endorsements include 17 congressional incumbents, 14 challengers, and 3 candidates for governor. The group says it has now endorsed 147 candidates nationally. Let's read from the sports page now. Under the Iowa football heading, Hawkeyes Jacobs Motivated by Challenge, story written by Steve Batterson, Dateline Iowa City. A year ago at this time, Justin Jacobs had questions, untested, but feeling like he was gaining an understanding of what he could do at linebacker for the Iowa defense, Jacobs was waiting for his chance. He had started one game in the abbreviated 2020 season, but looked for more and delivered last fall in 8 starts for the Hawkeyes. Quote, until you get out there and get a chance to compete, there are always questions in the back of your mind about whether you are ready for it or not, Jacobs said. Quote, it's a big jump from high school to college, a big step up. But the more I played, the more I saw that I was ready, unquote. The 6'4", 238-pound Englewood, Ohio native finished his sophomore season with 53 tackles. He forced a fumble that led to a touchdown in Iowa's win at Iowa State and intercepted a pass that led to a field goal drive in the Hawkeyes' victory over Penn State. With each outing, he made beside Jack Campbell and Seth Benson at outside linebacker, Jacobs gained experience and confidence. Quote, I feel like now I'm in a position to play faster. Things are coming to me more instinctively, and I'm reacting quicker because I know exactly what is going on, why we are doing it, and what the expectations are, Jacobs said. He likes his role at the outside position in the middle of Iowa's defense, a spot he shares with whoever earns the chance to replace Dane Belton as the Hawkeyes' starter at the cash position, the hybrid safety linebacker role Iowa utilizes against more wide-open attacks. Jacobs welcomes whatever snaps he can get and welcomes the challenge that often awaits. Quote, I like the position I'm in. I've always felt like it is fun to be out in space. There are some challenges that go along with that. You get tested on almost every down. Every down, you have to be on top of it, Jacobs said. Quote, you have to be on ready, whether you are going up against a wide receiver or a tight end, unquote. That test is part of what attracts Jacobs to his role. Quote, there's a challenge in going up against different types of players, and I love that. That's the fun part of the game, Jacobs said. Quote, one snap, it might be dealing with a quick receiver. The next, a physical tight end. That's a challenge I welcome, unquote. It's a test Jacobs believes he is better equipped to deal with as he works toward the start of his junior season. He has concentrated on building his knowledge base this summer, continuing to build on that foundation to be prepared for whatever situations he might find himself dealing with during the course of a game. Quote, there are things that I've learned as I go deeper into my career, and this summer I feel like I've been able to work on myself as an individual more, Jacobs said. Quote, my knowledge of the playbook, my knowledge of our schemes, knowledge why we do certain things, those are things I'm working on, unquote. Jacobs welcomes the chance to develop his total game. It's been a process for Jacobs, who initially selected the Hawkeyes over an offer from Ohio State, enrolled early, but was forced to miss spring practices, then because of a shoulder injury. That set him back, but Jacobs reminded himself that it was all a part of process, and strong faith and perseverance kept him moving forward. Quote, you come in and you learn that it takes time. Nothing is given, it's earned, Jacobs said. He said his initial season at the college level was humbling at times. Quote, you have to make sacrifices for the team. That was a big thing I had to learn. It wasn't necessarily about me. Maybe my teammate was doing better than me, Jacobs said. Understanding that, Jacobs returned to work. Quote, at the end of the day, you realize that if you keep putting the work in, that your day will come, Jacobs said. Quote, I'd be lying if I said it was frustrating at times. I'm a competitor. I always want to be out there, but that's not always the way it works. I had to earn it, and that challenge, it motivated me, unquote. Next, Shriners participants, alumni, ready for 50th Anniversary Iowa Shrine Bowl, filed by Ethan Petrick, Cedar Falls. 13 area football players, coaches, managers, and cheerleaders will participate in the 50th Anniversary Iowa Shrine Bowl at the Unidome in Cedar Falls on Saturday. Shrine Bowl Assistant General Manager Michael Hensing said the game's board of directors plan to honor all former participants in the annual best-on-best football game. Quote, "We have over 5,000 alumni that have played in the game for us," Henson said. "Players, coaches, cheerleaders, game officials, anyone that has been involved has been invited back. We are going to have an on-field recognition before the game for our alumni with Hall of Fame coach Ken Winkler addressing the crowd and alumni," unquote. In addition to Winkler's address, members of the Shrine Bowl class of 1989, former Northern Iowa Panther and Pro Football Hall of Fame quarterback Kurt Warner filmed a brief video to commemorate the event. In Warner's video, which was shown to the game's participants on Tuesday night, the former Regis Royal highlighted the spirit of the classic game. And now, listeners, that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, July 22nd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to Your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.